Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone to the Rebel Capitalist Show that, quite frankly, I have a ton of not just respect for, but admiration. I cannot say enough about this individual, but I need to start off by saying thank you to Mr. Jim Grant, because when I got into just understanding investment, finance, macroeconomics in 2012, there were a handful of people that really, really influenced my thinking. And Mr. Jim Grant was right at the top of the list. So I told him this when we had a panel discussion together at the New Orleans Investment Conference, that if it wasn't for him, I probably wouldn't have a YouTube channel right now, or a podcast, or a live event, or any of the other things that I have. So I need to start off by saying thank you to Mr. Jim Grant, not only for being on the show today, but for helping me get to where I am today.
Well, George, you're entirely welcome. I am taken aback. It's nice to hear. Thank you.
So, Jim, I know that you're a historian, a financial historian. So I want to try to tap into your wisdom and experience. For many, me included, it seems like we're living in unprecedented times, not just with COVID, but now with what's going on with Russia, Ukraine. I know history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. So what time frame in American history does what we're living through right now rhyme with?
Yeah. Well, of course, nothing is, few things are ever really literally new under the sun. The Spanish flu epidemic just after World War I certainly was much more lethal than today's version, COVID. As for the monetary stuff, you know, that might in fact come close to being a singularity where we are. We notoriously had a paper money regime in the early days of the Republic, and it was in reaction and indeed revulsion against that that the founders instituted something they thought would ensure a specie standard, gold or silver, years ahead. But I think never have we seen the overlay of raging inflation and 0%, now getting a little wonky, but a 0% federal funds rate. And as of now, we were speaking, so-called quantitative easing, QE, is still going. It's kind of winding down. But in the face of a pretty severe inflation, the Fed has set its little tiny policy interest rate at nil and continues to buy securities with money that didn't exist before the Fed tapped keys on a computer pad to call those dollar bills into existence. So in the monetary regime, we call it here at Grant's the PhD standard, which is the more or less unbridled management of our monetary affairs by former tenured faculty members at our leading universities. It's kind of a new thing.
Do you think it's similar to the 1940s?
Because it's similar a little bit in that between 1942 and 1951, the Fed instituted what we would now call yield curve controls. It pegged rates of interest along the curve, short to long. The bill rate was 0.375%. The long bond was something like 2.25, 2.5. Rates more or less where they are today. The bill rate, of course, 0.375% is towering over what we have seen in the past 10 years. But at that time, there was at least nominally an anchor on the value of the dollar. It was defined as 1/35th of an ounce of gold. Now, during World War II, there was no action so far as foreign central banks, which had the right to exchange their green paper for bullion at that rate, $35 to the ounce. All that, the mechanics of the gold standard were in suspense. So the gold standard was really in the deep freeze. It did not function. You could see that You can see that played out in the immense expansion of indebtedness in this country to finance World War II. So that was a kind of a flyaway debt regime with very low interest rates and financial repression, as it's now called.
And huge inflation.
Yeah, a huge inflation that was masked through price controls. But after controls came off, of course, that inflation came to the fore in the data. In 1946 and 47, I guess especially, we saw inflation in double digits, and the bonds still trading at 2.25. So that bears some resemblance to what we have today. But that was in the teeth of World War II. That was a rather different geopolitical proposition than COVID.
Yeah. Well,
pretext or the reason for the current round of monetary action, intervention.
Yeah, yeah. I hope it's not something that we'll see in the future with what's happening in Russia. You know, we'll keep our fingers crossed there that cooler heads prevail. I want to ask you just kind of a basic question that might not be so basic. Why are interest rates important? Why are free market interest rates important?
Well, I'm so glad you asked. I'm talking my book now. Our little journalistic lemonade stand is called Grant's Interest Rate Observer. You can imagine when there were no interest rates these past years, we have a heck of a thing for our business model. You know, magnifying glass to see the rate of interest. Interest rates are the Swiss Army knives of our finances. You know, you use them to calibrate or measure credit risk. You can tell how creditworthy or not a borrower is by the rate of interest that it pays. Interest rates discount future cash flows. They are the price of time, as someone once said. They help us to set investment hurdle rates. You can think of them as a traffic signals in a market economy. You know, they say go fast, go slow. They indicate the level of liquidity available. You know, if things are tight, rates are generally high. And if rates are peculiarly low, as they are today, you can kind of conjecture that the reason might be that somebody has his or her thumb on the scales, and that someone would be our monetary masters at the Federal Reserve. So I have contended, George, that because our interest rates are not discovered in the marketplace these days, but rather imposed from on high, or if not imposed, heavily influenced from on high, that to that extent, we are living in a kind of financial dream world. We are living in a hall of mirrors because things are not what they seem. If interest rates are essentially nil, there is no discipline in the financial markets, or very little discipline. You know, companies can say, in the year 2047, we'll be earning $6 a share. Oh, that's good. Yeah, very good. Now, a proper rate of interest would check that tendency because people would discount that claim and say, I'm not going to bet on that because, for one thing, I can get 5% on a treasury bill. I'm not going to take that
right
distant line of fantasy. So in this world of, you can also think of it, I guess, as zero gravity or weightlessness. You can imagine some of our billionaires floating around in space when they take their rides into the ether. You know? There's Jeff Bezos floating around. Without interest rates, we all kind of live in a zero gravity financial world. We're kind of floating around, you know, buying NFTs and DraftKings and Bitcoin, all that stuff, you know. Zero gravity, George. That's the concept.
It just pushes people further and further out the risk curve.
I think it does. Well, then you know, that's an old observation. One of my biographical subjects named Walter Bagehot, who was a guy who lived in the middle of the 19th century, and he was the kind of monetary muse of the gold standard era. He was credited or blamed for the doctrine that central banks in a time of crisis ought to lend freely, but he also said to lend at a high rate of interest and against good collateral.
Yeah.
Our central bankers today especially recall the idea of lending freely. The rest of it, they kind of forget.
Yeah.
Alluding to the national symbol of Britain, he said that John Bull can stand many things, but he can't stand 2%, meaning that a rate of interest as low as 2% would incite a lot of speculation and get a lot of people hurt because they would start buying the bonds of these emerging markets, you know, in South America and elsewhere. And there were a lot of cycles of emerging market boom and bust during Bagehot's time, and he linked unusually low rates of interest to that kind of financial behavior. Mm. And see it today. I mean, pension funds, and everyone needing a certain rate of interest with which to satisfy actuarial demands. It's, you know, looking around for things to do. You know, how do we do that when the 10-year treasury is yielding, you know, less than 2%? Well, junk bonds yielding 2.25%, or emerging Russian debt. That seemed promising until about 2 weeks ago. So I don't think we've seen the last of the consequences of this future for yield. In fact, I'm quite sure we have not. It'll come out in the wash.
Is it fair to say that if interest rates are the price of money, and money or dollars, currency, is one half of every single transaction, then if you're manipulating interest rates, you're effectively manipulating the price of everything that you can buy in the economy?
Yes, directly or indirectly. Certainly you're manipulating directly the price and valuation of financial assets. And insofar as financial assets feed into the other daily occupations in our economic world, they also manipulate that. That's the direct and consequential outcome of suppressed interest rates is, well, you know, kind of think of it, George. When interest rates are manipulated, especially when they are suppressed and pressed down to kind of law level, there's a lot of wasted capital. Like people undertake projects for which there's no real demand, a fanciful imagined one. The imagination can run rampant in this world that we decided a moment ago was kind of level of zero gravity. And there's a lot of waste. A lot of it's fun. People have taken up speculation not just because they hope to have a sound and sensible early retirement, because it's fun. And lights dance, and you get a little splash of confetti on your Robinhood account. You're used to it. There is amusement, and I guess that's an economic good. But there's also a lot of misdirected capital, a lot of white elephants, a lot of waste. And those have real world consequences.
How many of the businesses in Cathie Wood's portfolio do you think would exist today if we never got below 5% Fed funds?
I think fewer, to be sure. You know, that even during gold standard times, there were cycles of great enthusiasm over technological developments. You know, there were periodic railroad booms in the early and mid, especially in the mid 19th century. There were great excitement over all manner of canal boom in Britain and in this country as well. And so, you know, I think there's a tendency sometimes, and I certainly feel it because I have developed such an antipathy towards the Fed, how it operates, what it seems to stand for, how it's peopled, you know, what those people seem to believe. I've developed this antipathy, but I check myself at times, I try to, by recalling how many of the blemishes that we see in our own financial lives seem to be congenital to the human condition, not just to a given monetary regime. You know, people And I've often reflected that money is not humanity's best subject. If you around large sums of money, people just go crazy. Which reminds me of the unintended humor of the idea of an efficient market, in which there is the pure and hygienic discounting of expected cash flows, and there is the perfect competition and the perfect dissemination of information amongst all players, all these freaking no. That's not the way the world operates. When you get around a potential big sum of money, it's like falling in love, right? You go crazy.
Yeah, right.
And things and can't sleep at night. So I would say that the truth falls somewhere between the efficient markets hypothesis, the soft form, and my somewhat exaggerated hyperbolic riff on it. But Kathy Woods, I think there have been Kathy Woods's during the pure gold standard during the interwar fake gold standard called the gold exchange standard. There were Kathy Woods's during the Bretton Woods twilight fake gold standard. And there is the real Kathy Woods during our PhD standard.
Yeah, so we can't say that artificially low interest rates are the total cause of the speculation that we see in the market today, or the hysteria, but it definitely contributes or exacerbates.
It does, and what it also does is elongate these booms, deepen the risk and the preconditions of a serious bust. And then what happens? Well, the Fed comes in, and the Fed cuts that short. So we pile debt on debt, and boom on boom until boom.
I'd love to go back to the price discovery or the price signals and why that's so important. And when we were in New Orleans, you gave a speech and you told a story that I think illustrates beautifully why prices are so important, and also not just prices, but maybe the unintended consequences.
George, are you referring to 10-cent beer night at Cleveland's Municipal Stadium?
Yes, I am. I think that's it.
Okay, so I think the year is like 1974, and the Indians is now called the Guardians, but the Indians bought anything for 20 years since 1954, and the front office knew that it had to do something to get people into the park besides a good starting pitcher. So let us sell beers at the heavily discounted price of 10 cents, they decided. Right. So this is announced, and 25,000 self-selected individuals push their way through the turnstiles of this old cavernous ball yard. And the game progresses, and the cheering gets a little bit rowdy. And before you know it, fans are down the field introducing themselves to the players. And the score is 9-0. That's a forfeit, George. Cleveland lost the game. With the tying run on third base at the bottom of the ninth, wouldn't you know it? So it turns, there was a full moon, but that wasn't the problem. That wasn't the reason for the emergency room visits, the streakers, or the arrests. The problem was the mispricing of a substance even more potent than credit. So I've come to see it. Somebody said, you have to look at 10-cent beer night. I said, this is the perfect metaphor. An analogy for what we have been living through.
Yeah, exactly.
Astounding things in the going on in the marketplace, and the most improbable companies coming public, electric truck this and NFT that. We're going to be okay. I mean, the general, so Paul Volcker in the mid 1970s started talking about the indiscipline of finance. Gold definition of the dollar ended in 1971, famously. And during that inflation, there came to be a visible lack of discipline. And I've certainly seen this, perhaps you have as well, in the past 10 or dozen years. All sorts of stuff has happened that wouldn't happen, I think, with a 5% funds rate. It would be less amusing if we had a 5% funds rate. It'd be less good copy, as we say in journalism. It might have been better for the country.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to go back to just kind of the, you know, the Fed having their hand on the scale, if that's the right way to say it, or the Fed really being active in, let's say, money markets. I know there's a lot of information that we can get from the yield curve, and especially when it starts to flatten and when it inverts, you know, there's an extremely high probability that we go into a recession. But if the Fed is involved in the bond market, the treasury market, to the degree to which they are, how much weight should we give the flattening of the yield curve now? I guess that's my best question.
Yeah, good question. Well, let's define terms. So what is a yield curve? This is simply the spectrum of interest rates over time. So it stretches from zero, which is like this instant, to 30 years. And typically, bonds maturing later, longer dated securities have a higher yield because of the typical human preference for something available now rather than having to wait. So the impatience of the ordinary human being accounts for the conventional shape of the yield curve, meaning again, that a 30-year bond yields more than a 30-day treasury bill. That's the way typically it works. So enter the Fed. So the Fed now has control, typically pretty good control over the very, very short term. There's less control over the 2 to 5 year period. There's influence there, but not direct control. It has a rhetorical control. It tells you what to think. It primes the market by setting expectations. And so there's a little bit of a psychological game going on of longer days, but it has very little direct control over 30 years, okay, except for setting expectations of its own policy. What is happening now is that the difference between 2-year yields and 10-year yields has become very narrow. Now, that's not strictly the definition of a yield curve, as I take it, as an inflation signaling, you know, a recession signaling, or a boom signaling phenomenon. I think the better space of the yield curve to examine is that between the 30-day or 90-day bill rate, versus the 10-year treasury note. So the 10-year treasury note is now not quite 2%. The 90-day bill rate is much less. So the yield curve is not close to being flat there, but it is close to being flat 2 years to 10 years. And some people look at 2 years to 10 years. So what is different today? Well, one thing is that the flattening from 2 to 10 is taking place before the Fed even starts its projected cycle of raising interest rates. Never before seen. This is a very new thing.
I didn't know that.
What is a little bit different also about today is that there's a lot of leverage or debt in corporate America. Families are better financed than they were in 2006 and 2007. But corporations and the government itself, leave the government itself aside for a second, but there's a lot of debt in the corporate world, a lot of private equity transactions that have entailed a whole lot of leverage. Leverage being a Wall Street term for encumbrance or debt. So the question is, as we look at interest rates now beginning to rise and the yield curve beginning to flatten by some measures, and you say, well, what does that mean? Well, it might mean that the economy has so much debt that even a measured or a nominal rise in yields would put pressure on companies that owe money, and they would have to take steps to repay debt. They'd have to fire people, cut back production, do things to hunker down and sell division. So the fear, I think, is that the combination of the visible debt in the economy, the combination of that plus the visible flattening at some portions of the yield curve, and the intrusion of very high rates of inflation, or these three things are setting up for what we used to call stagflation in the 70s. Stagflation being, of course, the state of recession overlaid on inflation. Keynes once said that was unlikely or impossible, but it did happen way back when. And I guess it could happen again.
Hey guys, I want to remind you to get your tickets to Rebel Capitalist Live. This is the live conference I do twice per year with all of your favorite speakers from the Rebel Capitalist show and experts in investing, commodities, real estate, freedom, and liberty. All of your favorite topics, all of your favorite speakers. The next Rebel Capitalist Live is going to be in Miami, and tickets increase in price as we get closer to the event. So go to rebelcapitalistlive.com right now to get your tickets to the next Rebel Capitalist Live. It's the conference you cannot afford to miss. It'll help you increase your financial freedom and, more importantly, your personal freedom. You'll get intel that you won't hear anywhere else. Past speakers have included icons in macroeconomics, investing, and personal freedom and liberty. People like Dr. Ron Paul, Robert Kiyosaki, Brent Johnson, Lynn Alden, Jeff Snyder, Richard Werner, Mark Moss, Lynette Zhang, and Robert Breedlove, just to name a few. So once again, go to Rebel Capitalist Live right now and get your tickets today.
So why are we not seeing a steepening at the long end? Does it have something to do with the going out the risk curve, like we were talking earlier, from the standpoint of investors now might not buy treasuries for yield. They might buy treasuries for capital gains. Yeah. And do you think that may play into it?
Well, I think that the bulls on bonds would say this. I think they would say that, of course, these securities are denominated in dollars, and in time of geopolitical tension or war, what is dollar bills, and that the treasury market is the beneficiary, that foreign demand for treasuries, as we speak, has slightly strengthened. And they would say further that observe over the past dozen or more years that when the Fed moved to raise its funds rate, this little tiny overnight interest rate, that the longer dated portion of the treasury market did not go up in yield, but rather stayed where it was or even rallied, because people thought, well, now the economy really can't handle higher interest rates for the reasons that I've been trying to explain. And I think there's another thing, which is pure muscle memory. Interest rates have been falling since 1981.
Right.
So that's 41 years, and you have to be even older than I am, George. If that's conceivable, Wall Street, a successful Wall Street career is like 25 years. If you're any good at all, you're playing golf in Boca Raton at the end of 20 years. So you could have 1.5 Wall Street careers and never have seen the bond bear market.
Right.
So people. And I can tell you, because I was around in the last time we had a bond bear market, that when that came to an end in 1981, people were still scoffing at it through the 1980s. Interest rates can't go down.
Right.
And the most intriguing portion of that particular phase of our history that I can recall is something happened in 1984. And this is a little bit instructive on question of muscle memory. So I'm talking now about the 30-year treasury, and that yield peaked out in the fall of 1981 at 15%, if you can imagine, 15% on 30-year treasury bond. So That was, you know, that was about the time that Reagan had broke the air traffic controllers union, commodity prices broke. And it seemed as if this long cycle of inflation, thanks in part to Paul Volcker's very brutal monetary policy, was in the rearview mirror. But just go forward 3 years, 1984, and money growth was kind of percolating, and Milton Friedman and Henry Kaufman were saying, and these are two great thought leaders at the time, were saying, well, this is interest rates going right back up again, and they're going to go higher than they did before because of dot, like money growth. And in the spring of 1984, interest rates got to, again, in the 30-year bond, got to 14%. So that's how tenacious was the psychological hold on people that the interest rates are meant to go up.
Right.
It was almost, they can't go down, right? We know that. They have been going up since 1946. Well, that was only 35 years of a bond bear market. We've had a bond bull market for now, 42 years. You know, historians might now date it like 3 years ago when yields got to, below 1%, but interest rates at least have been going down or sideways for 41 years, and people are, I think, are kind of a mindset they are meant to continue to go down or sideways.
Yeah, so from 46 to 81, that was the last cycle. Is that correct?
That was the last bear market in bonds, yes.
What do you think triggered that? Or what, was there just one catalyst, or was it multiple things?
And
how would you learn from that to try to determine what a catalyst may be today?
Yeah. Well, when you look back on it, the catalyst was the Employment Act of 1946. Mm. And signed legislation saying that the United States was responsible, the government was responsible for a state of high employment and economic stability. So that was the institution of Keynesian doctrine into federal law. And you think, of course, that was it. But that was not exactly it. When about the time that Truman signed this, I'm just going from memory, the long bond yield was 2.25, 2.12, I guess that was the bottom, 2.12, about where the 10-year has been recently. Hmm. I can remember I actually lived through it. I was very young. I was only one. But my mother told me, George. But it took 10 years for that 2.25% long dated bond yield to get to 3.25.
Huh. Yeah, right.
Not until 1956 or so was that first 100 basis points, first one percentage point of that move higher.
Mm.
What happened was the catalyst was something we see again, as they say now, in the rear view. But you don't know at the time. And catalysts are almost innumerable now. I mean,
right.
What's wrong with these people? You got the Fed printing the $6 trillion of the past. M2 is up 40-odd% in the past 2 years. The federal deficit blowout. All these crazy ideas. You know, everyone's toying with or actually advocating so-called modern monetary theory. The whole world's crazy, if you ask me, George.
Yeah, but it seems like that muscle memory that you were referring to earlier makes interest rate cycles almost like that quote about going bankrupt. You know, it happens very, very slowly, and then all of a sudden, to your point, you know, in 46, it takes 10 years.
Well, interest rates are so funny in that respect. You know, I can't think of any other department of finance that exhibits these long cycles, and I'm not sure that they're a matter of physics. I'm not sure it's hard and fast. It's a law, capital L. But, since the U.S. Civil War, from like 1865, 1900, interest rates fell. From 1900, 1920 or so, it rose. 1920, 46, they fell. And then they, you know, they rose from 1946 to 81, and they have fallen for the past 41 years. So in each of these cycles, people became acclimated. 20 years is a long time to watch something and not develop the notion that it's meant to be, right, for all time. So that's the peculiar and intriguing nature of race. I've thought about this for a long time. I don't know what caused it. You can kind of overlay to a degree. You can kind of imagine that monetary regimes might explain it. But that's, I don't know. I leave it as a mystery, but something to know has happened, and to be wary of those who contend now that, oh yes, interest rates fall. That's what they do for a living.
Yeah.
Interest rates.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Let's go back, and I want to try to learn a little bit more about history. And one thing that I've tried to figure out is the late 1800s, from about the end of the Civil War, to call it the 1900 or so. I know that the date is hard to come by, but from what I've seen, you know, we had a deflation of about maybe 2%, 3% per year, but nominal GDP actually went up. So did nominal wages, from what I can gather, and even on a per capita GDP. So if you just look at those headline numbers, it would imply that the standard of living would have increased tremendously during that time frame, as far as the lot of the poor in the middle class, because their, you know, wages are going up, but their purchasing power is increasing at the same time. But then you hear a lot of people say that that was an extreme depression because of the deflation that we saw. Have you dove into that period of history, and what would your conclusions be? Was that a time in which the poor and middle class, where their lives got a lot better, or was there, what did it get worse because of the suffering, because it was a quote unquote depression?
Well, those 35 years entailed comprised many different business cycles. There were busts, there were booms, but if you generalize over the course of those 3.5 decades, I agree with your first observations that there was a persistent undertow in prices. Mm-hmm. On some people, it was very hard. You know, for farmers living from hand to mouth, barely making a subsistence income, felt keenly the nexus of rising railroad freight rates and stable or falling crop prices. It was a time of wondrous technological innovation. You think about the time before the incandescent bulb, that was later in the period, and the time after it. What did that do to productivity? What did the myriad inventions having to do with internal combustion engines and the like, the Humble typewriter, all these things came into being during that period. And as I understand the period, I've done some work in it. Real wages adjusted for inflation, just as you were saying before, were increasing. Mm-hmm. And people, I think, were, on the whole, to generalize in a kind of a cosmic way, I think that people were, their lots were improving, not the opposite. And you kind of, that's kind of borne out in the politics. You know, the populist movement was very noisy, and it demanded relief from these blood-sucking railroads, and from the money trust in the New York City, and from all other enemies, real and imagined. And they put up political candidates to run on a doctrine of a free silver, which is a kind of a code for inflation at the time. Mm. Those people lost a national election. You know, Grover Cleveland, the gold standard guy, won twice. William Jennings Bryan, later in the period, lost repeatedly in his bid for the presidency and for instituting a inflationary silver regime instead of the gold standard then in place. So I think it was a time of great progress, and to be sure, a time of not universal progress. Progress is never universal.
Right.
But my goodness, when you look back on what and comparing a lot of people in 1900 with a lot of people in 1866, I think it's pretty clear that the change was for the good.
Yeah. That's what it seems to me as well. So let's move on a couple of decades. And I know that you wrote a book about the Depression, I believe 1920, 1921, that most people forget. In fact, I think that might be
the title. If they've forgotten the book too, I should not have done, George.
But you know, when I've heard you talk about this quite extensively. And I thought, going back to 2020, obviously with COVID and the similarities to the Spanish flu, I thought, I wonder if that depression was caused by the Spanish flu, or the Spanish flu greatly contributed to that depression. Do you have any insights on that?
Well, the depression of 1920 began in the aftermath of America's participation in World War I. And it was a consequence, I believe, of the economic policies with which we fought World War I. So it was a huge inflation. The Federal Reserve just got into business in 1914, 1915. And so it got right down to work with facilitating the monetization of debt and expanding the money supply to finance the inflation that was part and parcel of almost every war.
Yeah.
Part of World War I. So the country emerged from this war with the pandemic and with an inflation. The pandemic died down is actually all too apt to description. The mortality of this was brutal, much worse than COVID. But if you go back and look at the coverage, journalistic coverage, and the official commentary on the pandemic, it was played down. There wasn't anything like the universal
hysteria.
Yeah, hysteria. So I don't think the Spanish flu was responsible for the depression. And the depression came about because of a huge inflation. The Fed met with very high interest rates, and there was a great credit contraction, and a great writing off of the investment errors of the World War I and post-war period. Mm. And what was interesting to me about this depression, it was met with a federal policy that was more or less this: balance the budget and impose punitively high nominal and, of course, real interest rates. So the inflation turned to deflation, prices actually fell, and wages fell. And that was the key, because if wages had remained the same as prices fell, there would have been mass unemployment, because corporations would have been losing money and would have had to discharge people en masse, right? Mm-hmm. Profit would have been crushed. But because wages fell along with prices, some companies at least were able to reestablish profitability at lower levels of nominal revenue.
Right.
So prices fell. There was a profit margin at that juncture. So there was no federal response beyond that. And the depression was relatively short-lived, over and done with in 18 months, but it was very severe. The stock market was down, basically saw it in half, commodity prices down this half or more. Unemployment not then measured, must have been in the teens. Corporate profitabilities certainly plunged initially. It was the last governmentally unmedicated business cycle downturn, and so to date in our history.
Yeah.
And And so you compare that with what happened in 1929 through 1946. I say that the Depression did not end in the 1930s. It persisted like a low-level chronic virus. You know, you can't get out of bed in the morning without really wanting to. And so I take the 1920-21 episode as a vindication of laissez-faire. Right. Of its superficial brutality and inhumanity against the well-intended intervention of the pre-Keynesian and then the quasi-Keynesian era of the 1930s.
What was the debt to GDP going into that depression?
Well, it was very high because federal debt was very high to GDP because of the financing of World War I. I think the federal government had like $1 billion going into the war, maybe had $20 billion coming out of it. I can't give you an overall debt to GDP ratio. I think that there was a fair amount of private borrowing facilitated by the inflationary environment of the war and its immediate aftermath. Certainly, farmers borrowed to expand production as the government urged them to do. You know, fence post to fence post. There was a huge agricultural depression in the wake of that inflation as agricultural prices plunged. The indebted farmers had to liquidate, and they did.
Yeah, you know, you're talking about sticky wages, and I remember looking at a chart of the rate of inflation going back to probably the mid-1800s in the United States. And you can see prior to the 1930s, it's just like a heartbeat. I mean, it goes up and down and up and down, you know, inflation, deflation, inflation, deflation, inflation, deflation. It kind of ends up around zero, or, you know, prices from 1800 to 1900 went down by 50%. But you had a lot of bouts of inflation in there as well. But once you get to the 1930s, you pretty much have almost zero deflation, a very, very little, you know, a couple of little blips there in the 1940s, and I think one during the GFC. But I always thought that maybe that's because wages now are so sticky, because in the 1930s, and correct me if I'm wrong, they came out with the minimum wage, they came out with welfare and Social Security. So, you know, it's got more government aggregate demand, if you will, when times are tough. And then you've got a floor on the price of wages. Therefore, a business can't, you know, if their revenues go down, instead of staying in business because wages go in down, now they just go bust. So then that affects the supply side. Do you think there's anything to that?
I do. The first thing that Herbert Hoover did when confronted with a business cycle downturn that was not going to be as mild as some thought it would be in the spring of 1930, he called all the industrialists, leading industrialists to Washington, and said that that he was not prepared to lead this country to a repeat episode of 1920-21. Mm. Fell so disastrously. And this time, he said to these people, including Henry Ford and others of that caliber, let us maintain wages above all things.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and Hoover was Secretary of Commerce to President Harding in 1920-21. And it was certainly well intended, but the effect was not what was intended. Mm. Mass unemployment. And I we're both talking in shorthand. All these things are a little bit nuanced. But I do think that, here's a quotation from William McChesney Martin. It's about 1955, I think, which is a year, by the way, in which the CPI did actually register a small year-over-year decline. Mm. So Martin, the Fed chairman, then was worried about inflation. He was always worried about inflation. He was one of the great warriors about inflation. And he said something, this is almost a direct quote. He said, don't forget, he said, the purchasing power of a dollar once lost to inflation is never regained. Mm. So it was at the time times before the gold standard was abrogated, that, as you say, there'd be cycles of deflation, cycles of inflation, and kind of over long stretches of time, the price level didn't change as measured. Although the measurement of the price level is really much less precise than many people would contend.
Yeah.
But now, you know, people say, what's the damage today of this transitory 7% inflation? Well, the problem is that 7% is gone. And you're saying that's gone.
Right.
Nothing.
That's what people, yeah, they even if it's not like they're going back down. Once you get a high watermark, it's not going back down to where it was in 2019. Even if it flatlined, it's still at that high watermark. If beef goes from $5 to $10, even if it flatlines for the next 2 years, it's still $10.
Well, beef can go back down, but the overall basket of things that you buy is not going to go down.
So, Jim, I know I've kept you over the allotted time, and I sincerely appreciate the conversation. I want to just end by asking not just your opinion on gold, because I think that would be a boring type of question that you've been asked, thousands and thousands and thousands of times.
Yeah, always the same answer.
talking about muscle memory, right?
Or genetic impulse.
Yeah. But more so, how do you value it? We say, this is cheap. Or this is expensive. How do you know when gold is cheap?
Oh, it's treacherous. This gold is so hard. I think conceptually, the price of gold is a reciprocal of the world's faith in central banks and managers. It's one divided by trust. I think that's okay as a conceptual starting point. But there's no PE. Price earnings ratio, there's no book value, there's no earnings yield, although gold does out yield. Only recently, there were like $18 trillion worth of bonds in the world priced to yield less than nothing in nominal terms. So gold was out yielding at zero, was out yielding that cohort of so-called fixed income securities. But gold is an idea, but it's certainly it's eminently, famously tangible. It's thicker than lead. It's the most wondrous thing probably in the periodic table for all sorts of reasons. But it's for all of that, for all its tangibility, all its physical beauty, it's a concept. It's a monetary concept, and you buy it because you just know that things are going the wrong way at the Fed. Mm. But you have to be careful because. I've owned this stuff, I was about to say off and on. I've owned it on with varying degrees of intense conviction all my adult life, basically. And just when you think that, like in the aftermath of the Lehman crack up, aha, it was down a quick 30 or 40%.
Yeah, there's liquidity.
Right, and people were selling because it is liquid, right? A friend of mine who, a dear business acquaintance, that's different, but guy's very close to you in a business way, committed suicide. He was a gold guy who committed, all his employees were in these gold, little tiny gold stocks, and he had done so well with them, and they thought so well of him, and he was a hero of his small town. He was a banker, and he was so all about gold, and he took a shotgun in the shower because he could not handle it. So you have to be careful. You have to be careful. You can't fall in love with anything. You can't fall in love with bonds, stocks, land, gold, nothing. Love is for something else. So gold is again, it's an essential thing to own. Something, it's an essential part of one's portfolio because we live in a world of monetary fictions. But these monetary fictions can be very powerful. The narrative of a successful Fed. Think of the durability of the narrative of the all-knowing Fed. It survived the visible ineptness of 2004, 5, 6, 7, when they had no idea what was going on in front of their very face. It has survived the ineptness of the past year when they had no conviction at all about the risks that they ran in calling inflation transitory. So as seemingly feeble and as vulnerable as the PhD standard might seem to be, it is in some respects as hard as steel. People do believe it. And believing it, they're prepared to turn their back on gold because they're simple, because they know that there are better things in the world to own. So that's my little speech on gold.
Yeah, that's great, Jim. Well, I've got about 1,000 more questions, but we'll have to get to that next time. So
for a 1,000th podcast, we'll get through it all.
Yeah. So let's talk about Grant's interest rate observer.
Oh, yes.
You talked about it earlier. What is it all about for, I mean, my viewers who are, you know, my age and older, they're going to know exactly what it is, but,
very quickly, Jordan, this is my life's work. It's going to be 40 years old next year, just like me.
Yeah, that's right. You started it when you were one. We were talking about that.
Yeah, my mother helped me, for sure, for the first 3 years. No, it started in 1983. I've been doing it since then. And we publish every 2 weeks. We mean to have the best ideas, the best prose, the most imaginative, forward-looking commentary analysis, and the funniest cartoon on page one. And sometimes we succeed. That's Grant's interest rate observer. That's 12 pages. You subscribe at I've forgotten what some people call the very high price, but I regard it as an absurdly low price at $1,400 a year. So, a little less, perhaps, if you ask nicely. But you know, that's what we do for a living. And and one last thing. Some people might be wondering, okay, this guy is 75 and a half years old. What is he doing writing about this stuff at this grandfatherly stage of his life? Well, I don't know the answer to that, but I can tell you that somebody took out a 10-year subscription just last week. Yeah, 10 years. How's that for optimism? Okay, gotta go.
All right, Jim, what's the URL?
The Google Grant's interest rate observer, and it's grantspub.com. We have a big website. We have all sorts of things to lure you into what we do. And we have something called Grants, Almost Daily Grants, which is available for the price of free. You can read ADG, Almost Daily Grants, for nothing. And then you'll find yourself in the sales funnel. Exorably. To the flagship product, which costs, a ridiculously low annual fee.
All right, Jim. Thanks for your time.
Okay, George. Great to talk. Love your hat.
Thanks, buddy.
Okay, so long.
All right, bye.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com. Or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.